Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, the March 25th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with A New Age of Naval Warfare, and it's by Alessa Pantolano. With the sinking of the Sergei Katov in early March, a whopping one-third of Russia's Black Sea Fleet has been disabled. The maritime theater of the war in Ukraine remains the most significant since the Falklands, but it is also part of a larger story about naval power, which has come back as a central feature of struggles from the Black Sea to the Red Sea, South China Sea, and the Taiwan Strait. This is not just about the strategic value of capital ships to project a nation's international standing and ambitions in an archival international system. Naval power matters today more than ever before because of how modern society's relationship with the sea has evolved. Today we live in a maritime century, one in which the very foundations of the prosperity that underwrites open economies rests upon maritime physical and digital connectivity. Sea lanes feed us, keep us warm, and deliver the furniture of daily life. Some 97% of the internet and a major portion of the international energy use relies on an undersea spaghetti bowl of cables and pipelines that closely mirror commercial shipping routes. This multi-layered network of physical and digital connectivity is safe and reliable only until it is not. In recent years, places as diverse as Somalia, Tonga, the United Kingdom, and Taiwan have experienced economic losses because of disruptions to critical undersea infrastructure. By the beginning of the year, the relatively sophisticated capabilities of Yemen's Houthis exposed just how vulnerable the steady supply of basic commodities, from tea bags to the average household in Britain to core components of electric cars across Europe, can actually be. This unprecedented reliance on maritime connectivity has made activities at sea a primary target of the authoritarian regimes and non-state groups. Actions such as a sabotage of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the gas pipeline that links Estonia, Finland, and Sweden, and the disruption to international shipping caused by the Houthi missiles and drones share one thing. These actions highlight a realization that maritime connectivity is a pressure point with significant political value, and that pressure can be applied by state or non-state actors. Countries like China, in particular, are pursuing the naval means to seize the opportunities emerging from such a realization. Whether in the field of technologies for deep seabed exploration and exploitation, shipping capacity, or, above all, in the context of sheer naval might, China is setting new records in both quantity and quality of its investments. In the past decade alone, China has added over twice the number of ships to its surface fleet as what the entire French Navy commands. Chinese authorities understand that in a maritime century, their ongoing naval buildup is a down payment for maritime superiority, if not supremacy, in a potential major war in the China Seas, the Taiwan Strait, or beyond. President Xi of China and his appointment of Hu Zongming, an operationally experienced submariner at the helm of the Navy, confirms that a new generation of flag officers is entrusted to deliver the readiness if ever needed. This is why navies matter, and why the U.S. and the allies in Europe and Asia are actively debating how to invest in them. Leaders in countries like Japan and Australia are investing in their navies, from counterstrike to surface, carrier and submarine projection capabilities, so that they can collectively meet the growing authoritarian challenge at sea. That includes Japan's unveiling in December of 2023 the largest defense budget in its post-war history, and Australia, which is already procuring nuclear-powered submarines through AUKUS, AUKUS, announcing last month plans to double its surface fleet. However, others like the U.S. and Britain are finding it harder to meet growing naval demands. In the United States, the Navy will ask for only one Virginia-class submarine for the next fiscal year budget instead of two because of the limits of industrial capability. In Britain, a recent parliamentary report noted how plans to introduce several new classes of ships need more shipyards first. In a contested maritime century, we should start thinking about navies as the ultimate national security insurance policy. Like any insurance, they demand regular investments against risks that are unlikely but potentially grave. Navies work best to deter would-be aggression, but their industrial base to generate their capabilities underwrites military credibility. Crucially, when all else fails, the credibility stands to make certain that in the hour of need, the hardest challenges will be met and overcome. Next, we have The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Pakistan's generals fail to fix an election. Pakistan's worst-kept secret is that its military dominates its government. Whether to safeguard the nation against chaos or to protect their own privileged access to power and wealth, its generals have manipulated the country's politics for decades. Pakistan's voters, like voters elsewhere, want change. February's ugly election fiasco shows that it's only getting harder for the army to prevent political disruptors from upending their plans. But, unfortunately for Pakistan's future, they have yet again managed to override public demand for a new direction. A brief recap. The generals and popular leader Imran Khan decided some time ago they could no longer trust one another. The army then removed Khan from his post as prime minister and put him in jail, as it has done many times in the past, and to many other prime ministers who refused to respect their dominance. He now faces more than 150 criminal charges, all of which he denies. When the brass refused to let him contest February's national elections, even from prison, aides in Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, the PTI, created AI-generated Khan speeches that were then broadcast around Pakistan. In a nation where 40% of the voters are illiterate, army-dominated courts ruled that ballots could not include the symbol of Khan's party, a cricket bat to reference Khan's professional sporting prowess. But the party vowed to press ahead. When the generals refused to allow the PTI members to appear on the ballots, many ran as independents. Both the army and a former prime minister, the then-exiled rehabilitated Nawaz Sharif, was confident that destroying Khan's candidacy would assure a victory for Sharif. It did not. Even after manipulating the courts and the media, stuffing the ballot boxes, and turning off mobile phone service and social media in areas where Khan voters were setting their get-out-the-vote plans, the nation's self-appointed overlords could not stop voters from shocking Pakistan and the world by handing victory to the independents who stood for Imran Khan's PTI party. They didn't win a majority, but they did win more seats than any single party. It took the army and its political subordinates 3 weeks to untangle the mess and find a way to keep Khan's party out of power. On March 4th, Pakistan's newly formed parliament announced that Shahbaz Sharif, Nawaz's brother, and the interim prime minister since the army grabbed power again last August, will then again lead a coalition government, all in the name of stability. It's reasonable to wonder why Sharif or anyone else would want the job. Pakistan ranks 161st out of 191 countries in the UN's Human Development Index. Its economic prospects remain poor. About 40% of Pakistan's people live in poverty, and inflation stands at about 30%. Power outages are a fact of daily life. To pay its foreign debt to avoid default, Pakistan's government must come up with more than $20 billion. Its current reserves have dwindled to less than $10 billion. The country is increasingly isolated. China and Saudi Arabia traditionally have invested in Pakistan, increasingly see the country as a bad commercial bet. Traditional security partners in the United States are less interested, particularly since the U.S. withdrawal from neighboring Afghanistan. And although Khan has vowed that the PTI lawmakers will sit in opposition, the party's followers have already demonstrated an ability and a willingness to generate major trouble in the streets of Pakistan's largest cities. Worse still, the army establishment has shown Pakistan's voters that their country's democracy cannot create the change that they need. That bodes ill for the nation and all who would lead it, whether they're elected or not. Now let's head over to the brief. Let's start with health. Zyn triggers fears of a new teen nicotine craze. And this is by Jamie Ducharme. Not long ago, Juul was seen as the new Marlboro. Smoking was not that cool anymore. Rates had plummeted amongst the U.S. adults and teens. But then came a sleek, addictive product with flashy advertising tactics that took off like wildfire. It soon became clear that e-cigarettes were hooking teens who otherwise would not have gone near nicotine. Now, Juul is out, and Zyn is in. It's even more discreet than Juul, with no plumes of vapor. All the user has to do is tuck a small pouch of nicotine, additives, and flavorings under their lip for up to an hour. Over that time, the pouch releases a steady hit of nicotine, more than that in a cigarette, but delivers much more slowly. Like Juul, it contains no tobacco. You're not alone if you're just hearing about Zyn, but it's been on sale in the United States since 2014. Like other products that launched around that time, including Juul, it hit the market when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, had few regulations for new tobacco and nicotine products. The agency retroactively required these brands and others to prove their benefit for public health enough to stay on the market. And Zyn's manufacturer has filed the necessary applications, but the FDA has not reached a decision as of yet. Without regulatory oversight, Zyn has become the latest product to lure people to a new and, at least seemingly, less dangerous way to consume nicotine. It's a parallel world with what happened with the e-cigarettes, says Majayak Ganowitz, a nicotine and tobacco-controlled researcher at the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York. Still, Zyn is nowhere close to as ubiquitous as Juul once was, according to the most recent available data. About 4.5% of U.S. adults vaped and 11.5% smoked in 2021, but only about 2% used smokeless tobacco products. And just 1.5% of U.S. teenagers said they concurrently used nicotine pouches in 2023. For context, at the height of Juul's popularity in 2019, 27.5% of U.S. high schoolers said they vaped in the past month. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison, says Corey Henry, director of the U.S. communications at Zyn's parent company, Philip Morris International, PMI. To be honest, it's not even an apples-to-asteroids comparison, he says. But oral nicotine products have picked up significant traction in recent years. The Federal Trade Commission recently reported that the category's U.S. sales more than doubled from $453 million in 2020 to roughly $1 billion in 2022. And Zyn's U.S. business grew by 62% from 2022 to 2023 alone, and that's according to an earnings report from PMI. Zyn is also starting to go viral, which raises concerns about the product's appealing to teens who might otherwise stay away from nicotine, says Dr. Robert Jackler, a tobacco advertising expert and professor emeritus at Stanford University. The market for these pouches is rapidly growing, and it's being driven by many attributes that would be attractive to young people in the way the e-cigarettes such as Juul were, says Jackler, including appealing flavors such as mint, citrus, and coffee, and advertising that it makes users look attractive, active, and cool. We've seen this playbook before, says Jackler. There's even a name for people who post about the pouches, Zynfluencers, prompting concern from some public health officials and lawmakers. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer recently called for a crackdown on products like Zyn, warning parents that companies lock their sights on these young kids, teenagers, and even lower, and then use the social media to just hook them in. Zyn does not hire influencers or use models younger than 35 in its ads, says Henry. It also bars anyone younger than 21 from accessing its website and flags social media posts that depicts underage or dangerous use of Zyn to the platforms. But the company cannot police the internet, says Henry. Platforms, including TikTok, already prohibit posts that show or encourage underage drug, alcohol, or tobacco use. Yet Henry says these policies do not always catch everything. Henry says PMI does everything required and more to prevent the underage Zyn use. Its ads, he says, are meant to appeal to adult tobacco users looking to switch, not to teenagers. The average Zyn user is 39 years old and previously used another tobacco or nicotine product. And that's according to 2023 company research that was conducted amongst its customers with 21 and older. That was the case for Will, a 30-year-old living in Brooklyn who asked to use only his first name for privacy. Will started experimenting with tobacco products in high school and has smoked, vaped, and used smokeless tobacco, or dip, in the past. He started regularly using Zyn about 8 months ago and said he feels cleaner and better for his health than other nicotine products that he's tried. I see it as a sustainable habit, he says, until research proves me wrong, which it might, he says. Research on the safety of nicotine pouches is ongoing, and questions remain about the effects of its long-term use. But other oral products, including Snus, which is similar to Zyn but contains tobacco instead of just nicotine, has been studied for decades and seems to present significantly lower risks of cancer and other diseases versus cigarettes. In 2019, the FDA allowed some Snus products to be explicitly sold as lower-risk alternatives to cigarettes, marking the first time the agency has granted that permission. Based on what it is currently known, the nicotine researcher, Gonowitz, says it's safe to assume nicotine pouches that don't damage the lungs in any way that cigarettes and e-cigarettes do because users are not inhaling anything. Pouches also seem to contain fewer of the cancer-causing chemicals found in traditional chewing tobacco, he says. Aside from addiction, their primary health risk for adult users likely lies in nicotine's potential to harm the cardiovascular system, which is a particular risk for people with pre-existing heart conditions. Products like these are also risky for oral health. Anytime you park a foreign substance between your teeth and gums, you're taking a risk of dental problems, such as cavities and gum disease, adds Jackler, who practiced for decades as an ear, nose, and throat physician. Some researchers have raised additional concerns. One 2023 study found that oral nicotine products like Zyn contain low levels of potentially harmful substances, including ammonia and formaldehyde. And in a small 2024 study of adults who use nicotine pouches, almost all of them reported some kind of unpleasant side effect, including mouth lesions, nausea, and a sore throat or mouth. That certainly seems to be safer than tobacco cigarettes, says study co-author Ashley Dowd, a postdoctoral research fellow at Johns Hopkins University. But having a general sense that they're safe would concern me, especially, she says, if that belief prompts people who don't currently use nicotine to pick up a pouch thinking it's harmless. Dowd's study also found that most pouch users continued to smoke or vape on the side. Another 2023 study found the same thing among users between the ages of 15 to 24. Using multiple nicotine products is concerning, Jackler says, since it can deepen addiction and make continuing smoking more likely. And people, including teenagers, who are new to nicotine may become addicted more easily if they're using it in multiple ways. Students may have few opportunities to smoke cigarettes during the school day, but if they can fill in the blanks by popping a nicotine pouch while sitting in class, says Jackler, they may get used to using nicotine and become dependent. The number of people who continue to smoke or vape in addition to using the pouches suggests that some users can't or do not want to completely switch, perhaps because pouches do not deliver nicotine to the bloodstream rapidly enough to quell their cravings, as some recent research hints. But if people were to entirely quit cigarettes or vape in favor of pouches, as a physician, I would welcome that, says Jackler. On the other hand, he adds, I wish they never got addicted to begin with. Next we have, from the business section of the brief, the companies driving the U.S. green revolution. This is by Shayla Raghav. The booming green technology sector has emerged as a beacon of hope, not only for investors. It's predicted to grow to $9.5 trillion by the year 2030, and for the many workers that it employs, but also for the planet at large. Green tech companies leverage innovation and new business models to curb greenhouse gas emissions, displace unsustainable materials, and reduce the demand for non-renewable natural resources. A new statistical ranking ranks 250 of America's top sustainability-focused companies based on their positive environmental impact, financial strength, and innovation to see who is rising to the top of the field. ZeroAvia, the top company on the list, develops hydrogen electric planes and already has 1,500 provisional orders for its aircraft. The most important action is to tackle the hard-to-abate sectors such as aviation, says CEO Val Miftikov to Time magazine. Yes, we can, and we will tackle the low-hanging fruit like switching to electric vehicles and building more renewables. But as that happens, we will have stubborn emissions in certain sectors that begin to make up a vast majority of the greenhouse gas impacts. Brimstone, based in Oakland, California, ranks fifth. The company produces zero-carbon cement, a groundbreaking innovation for the production of the material responsible for 5.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. With urbanization showing no sign of slowing down, experts regard reducing the climate impact of cement production as critical. Marcelo D. Oliveira, vice president of materials science and geology at Brimstone, told Time magazine that the green tech boom is as much about inspiration as it is about innovation, inspiring a new generation of scientists and ecopreneurs to deploy their talent to addressing climate change. Our most valuable resource in solving this problem is people, says De Oliveira. We urgently need more individuals dedicated to addressing it. What's most striking about the ranking is the diversity of types of companies at the upper reaches of the green tech, a range spurred by significant government investment via the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. The industry now reflects major investments in the panoply of approaches that will be required to reduce the environmental impact of everything from food to heavy industry and develop renewable power from solar to fusion. And I think we have time for one more. Five things that therapists do when they feel lonely. And it's by Angela Haupt. True friendships can take years to develop, which isn't exactly comforting to the 1 in 3 U.S. adults who say they're lonely right now. But you don't need to wait for a new BFF to feel better. Small acts can help give you immediate relief from loneliness, according to the experts. We ask therapists what low-effort steps they take in their own lives when isolation starts to creep in. First, we have Go People Watching. When Samantha Bender, a social worker in El Paso, Texas, feels lonely, she heads to a local coffee shop where she can people watch while sipping on a saffron latte and reading the latest Stephen King novel. Sometimes loneliness isn't about our direct relationship, she says, but how we feel in relation to the world that's around us. There's so much going on in public spaces, new sounds, scents, and sights, that it grounds her in the present moment and distracts her from tinges of loneliness. You could soak it all in and feel like you're part of something without having to extend a lot of effort, she says. We don't always have the mental energy and capacity to connect with others one-on-one. Next we have join an easy group class. When Courtney Morgan, a therapist in Louisville, Kentucky, wants to be around like-minded people without having to try too hard, she goes to a yoga class. Sometimes I want to feel connected without actively engaging in a conversation, she says. She tells her clients to seek out structured programming that they're interested in as well, whether it's fitness-related, educational, or maybe something artsy. During your class, aim to appear approachable, she says. Resist the urge to look at your phone. Make eye contact with people. Smile. Ask a stranger if you can sit next to them. And thank the instructor. All are small ways to feel better connected. Next we have send a voice text. Audrey Schoen, a marriage and family therapist in Granite Bay, California, loves communicating via voice message. When she meets someone new and exchanges contact information, she sends them an audio message instead of firing off a text. And when she feels lonely, she reaches out to friends in that same way, or replays old voice messages that she saved. I love receiving voice messages, and I love sending them, she says. They feel so much more personal and are especially fun ways to keep in touch with friends who live far away. Next, we have cuddle a pet. Research shows that spending just 10 minutes interacting with cats and dogs reduces levels of the stress hormone cortisol. So it's no wonder that Allison Giebold, a therapist in Morristown, New Jersey, seeks out her pups when she craves company. I find it hard to feel lonely in the presence of animals, she says. There's love there, and there's loyalty there. Plus, pets open the door to social opportunities. She says once she advised a lonely client to take her poodles to a local park and position herself in a way that was really open, not scrolling on her phone. Well, it worked. People made small talk with her and asked her to pet the dog, which lifted her spirits. Dogs are an invitation, she says. And lastly, we have flip through old photos. It's so easy to forget fun, fulfilling times when you're all alone. But looking at photos of your favorite family members can help. It immediately sparks joy, says San Francisco therapist Erica Bent, who does this whenever she feels isolated. Thinking of beautiful moments helps me remember that I'm worthy of connection. It also helps reignite the possibility of feeling less alone, she says, which is sometimes the most powerful antidote to loneliness. And actually, we do have time for one more short one. Approved, a first for abortion, a constitutional right for France. France became the world's first country to explicitly enshrine abortion rights into its constitution amid a rollback in reproductive rights in the United States and elsewhere. Following a final vote on March 4th, the bill was approved by members of parliament summoned to Paris by President Emmanuel Macron for a special meeting. The historic bill needed at least 3/5 of the vote to pass. Macron's government proposed the wording, quote, "The law determines the conditions by which is exercised the freedom of women to have recourse to an abortion, which is guaranteed," unquote. The bill has been well received across the political spectrum, with no major parties in parliament opposed. The move marks the 25th amendment made to the Fifth Republic's founding document. "We're sending a message to all women. Your body belongs to you, and no one else can decide for you," said Prime Minister Gabriel Attal. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from the March 25th, 2024 edition of Time magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.